From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Tomorrow's NFC Championship game will feature polite bears delighted to host appreciative Packers. Really? Just ahead on Only a Game, a history of what some feel is the most acrimonious rivalry in sports. Also, the latest in the Lance Armstrong saga, and we'll pass go and discuss a new documentary featuring Monopoly. Also ahead, kite skiers take a tiny upstate New York town by storm, or maybe just by wind.
When it's really windy and you jump really high, it's just like getting shot out of a cannon or something, and there's really nothing like it. And you can go out, if it's windy like this, and just ride for 8 hours straight.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow in Pittsburgh, the Steelers will host the AFC Championship game against the Jets, whose sportsmanship, professionalism, and respect for opponents has been delighting sports fans ever since Monday. In Sunday's early game, the Packers will meet the Bears for all the NFC marbles. Green Bay and Chicago have met 181 times over the last 8 decades. During those games, opponents have exchanged many pleasantries, inquired as to the welfare of spouses, and made plans to get together for a nice meal. Now, these teams loathe each other, always have. Here to discuss the various ways in which that has been demonstrated is Cliff Crystal, co-author of Mud Baths and Blood Baths, the inside story of the Bears-Packers rivalry. Cliff, welcome to Only a Game.
My pleasure.
For those of our listeners who don't know much about the ongoing hostility between the Bears and the Packers, what's the best way to begin to describe that rivalry?
Well, they started playing in 1921, which was basically the second year of the NFL, and they've never liked each other much. There's been a few more hostile periods than others. There was a period of time in the 1940s and again in the 1980s where, the games were more like Pier 6 brawls. There was a game in 1946, for example, when Packers had an end by the name of Carl Mullinaw. He was hit by John Schickel of the Bears, and Packers and even some Bears claimed it was a vicious cheap shot. And the injury, Mullinaw's injuries were so gruesome that rumors circulated around Green Bay that after he'd been carried off the field into the hospital, that he had died there. He had suffered like 5 dislocated vertebrae, a concussion, a broken nose, facial cuts, 3 broken teeth, and he never played again.
Oh, my gosh. For all the hype about the rivalry, Chicago and Green Bay have met only once in the postseason. Seems remarkable. That was in 1941 when Chicago beat Green Bay in the divisional playoffs on their way to the NFL championship. I wonder, does the fact that the rivalry has grown largely out of regular season games underscore its intensity?
I don't think so. There's 2 explanations for why they haven't met in the postseason. One is they were in the same division, and until 1967, there were no playoffs. There was just a championship game. Mm-hmm. So the winner of the division, their conference, played in the championship game, and the Bears and Packers often fought it out for that honor. Then starting in 67, it just so happened that whenever the Packers were good, the Bears weren't very good, and vice versa.
The divisional game in 1941 was held just days after Pearl Harbor. I would suggest that perhaps in the national interest, they should have waited to play that game, but that's not how the Packers and Bears have done things, I guess.
No, and the season went on. They were at the tail end of the NFL season at that time. Actually, the Packers had finished their season a week earlier and clinched their share of the title. On December 7th, 41, the Bears had to play the Cardinals, and the Bears had to win to clinch their share of the tie. Curly Lambeau took all 30 of his players down to Comiskey Park, and they were sitting in the upper deck when the announcement was made about the bombing at Pearl Harbor, and all those players knew they were going to war. And they more or less just crushed the Packers. And then they went on to win the NFL title. The interesting story is that the Bear-Packer game was bigger than the NFL championship.
There's no way to describe all the heated moments over the course of this 80-year rivalry, but does one particular moment stick out for you?
You know, the Packers were given no chance after a miserable exhibition season, and they faced the Bears in the opener. I believe it was 1980. And Chester Markle, bespectacled kicker, had a field goal attempt blocked in overtime, and the ball just happened to bounce into his arms, and he carried it like a loaf of bread into the end zone. The Packers upset the Bears, and the Bears were a much better team, and they turned around, and when they played the rematch in Chicago, they beat the Packers 61-7. And Dan Hampton said after the game, "We wanted to score 100 to rub it in their noses." So that kind of gives you an idea about how much these teams like each other. You know, one of my favorite stories was a game in 1945. The Bears had a player named Lee Arto, who was regarded as one of the dirtiest in the league. And he had taken a cheap shot against one of the Packers in the opener. And so the Packers are out to get him in the rematch in Chicago. And a guy by the name of Ken Kuiper nailed Arto in his face. And again, it was just a gruesome injury. He broke his nose, his upper and lower jaws, knocked out 11 teeth. You know, that's one of my favorite stories, at least to read about.
How has the rivalry influenced fan behavior?
You know, the fans got into it from the very start. I mean, the Packers' old lumberjack band, you know, guys dressed in Mackinaws and deer hunting clothing would go down to Chicago and march through the streets. I mean, they started doing that in the 1920s, 1930s and 40s bars, and the two cities would run special trains back and forth. And it's always been a huge rivalry to the fans. It's lost some of its intensity, though, because there haven't been that many big games in recent years. But, you know, this game has, stirred the passions again.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot, Cliff, because that's what we do on this program. With a trip to the Super Bowl on the line, who wins the 182nd meeting of the Packers and the Bears?
Well, I think the Packers have the better team. The Bears are at home. I guess I'd have to pick the Packers because I think their talent's a little stronger and they have a better quarterback. But I think it'll be an extremely close game. And I think if it lives up to everything people expect, that it will be considered the greatest game in the 182-year rivalry. It's certainly the biggest since 1963 when the Bears and Packers had a showdown for the conference championship, the Hallis Bears and the Lombardi Packers. And the Bears won that one.
Cliff Crystal is co-author of Mud Baths and Blood Baths, the inside story of the Bears-Packers rivalry. It's published by Prairie Oak Press. Cliff, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
UConn, UConn, UConn declare women's college basketball headlines. Hey, wait a minute, declare Baylor followers. That's because Baylor is currently the number one team in the nation and is preparing for what it hopes will be a second title run in 6 years. Only a Game's Greg Eklund was in Lawrence, Kansas this week to witness Baylor's drubbing of Kansas, and he has this report.
On November 16th, UConn continued its unbeaten streak by defeating one of last year's Final Four teams, the Baylor Lady Bears.
2 seconds to go. Sims, 1 second. She gets a shot off, but no! UConn will win 65-64. Baylor could not get the ball down the floor in time.
But when the Huskies' record of 90 straight victories ended December 30th at Stanford, the Waco kids took over the number one ranking. It ended a run of 51 consecutive weeks. The Huskies were ranked number one in the Associated Press poll, the longest in the history of the poll. While the snow plows were out in full force outside Allen Fieldhouse in Lawrence, Kansas Wednesday night, Baylor was in the midst of plowing over another opponent. Before Wednesday night's game, the Lady Bears had beaten their opponents by an average of 33 points a game, the best in the nation. Against the Kansas Jayhawks, who had a respectable 14-3 record going into the game, the Lady Bears won by 39 points, 76-37. Despite routinely destroying their opponents, Coach Kim Mulkey says she keeps her team grounded.
I guarantee our kids don't even know the statistic you just said. We prepare for every game. We remain hungry. We try to get better, and we're playing for a championship. We'd love to get a Big 12 championship and then vie for a national championship.
One of the big reasons for Baylor's success this season is the improved play of 6'8" sophomore Brittany Griner. As the National Freshman of the Year, she set a single-season NCAA record for block shots with 223. Because of her height, Griner became accustomed to all the attention in high school.
I thought it was cool. You know, now it's kind of like normal now. It's kind of like I expect it. You know, just like getting double and triple team. You know, it's like that's like one-on-one for me because I'm so used to it now.
There was a regrettable moment last season when Griner threw a punch at Texas Tech player Jordan Barncastle, for which Griner was suspended for 2 games. But no matter how bad it got on the basketball court, Griner says she found solace in the Baylor campus life.
On the campus, the atmosphere is just, it's like a family. Like, that's one of the main reasons why I came to Baylor. It just felt like family, home away from home. Definitely people always come up to me, you know, and talk to me, just encourage me and tell me to keep up the good work.
As one who played on a national championship team and coached one, Mulkey has seen the best players through the years. Would she consider Griner a once-in-a-lifetime player?
I would have to tell you that she is, because she dominates the game on the defensive end of the floor. And she makes you change your thought process as a player and as a coach on how you're going to attack her. And I've seen the great ones through the years. I've played with some of the great ones. I've never seen those great ones change a coach's game plan as much as Brittany Griner does.
The emergence of Baylor and a handful of other teams besides UConn suggests that there's more parity this year on the women's college basketball scene, but not enough to warrant the expansion of the tournament. The coaches of the Big 12's top 2 ranked teams have spoken out against including more than 64.
64 teams is an honor. If you're not one of the 64, you don't deserve to be in there. I don't want to water down anything.
Gary Blair is the head coach of the 6th-ranked Texas A&M Aggies. He's also steadfast in his opposition toward expanding the tournament field.
I'm completely against it right now because there isn't enough teams to be able to do it. We've got just enough good teams to fill the whole 64 bracket and the NIT. And I think that's just where our game is right now. Sometimes there is nothing worse than to see in a bad women's basketball game.
Gary Blair says there are better games among the top 10 teams because UConn coach Gino Auriemma and Tennessee coach Pat Summitt have laid the groundwork for others like Baylor and Texas A&M to succeed. In fact, Baylor won the 2005 national championship. Brittany Griner says she won't be satisfied with just another trip to the Final Four. Her goal?
Oh, win it, of course. I mean, but, you know, got to get there first to win it.
Baylor hosts Texas Tech today in Waco. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Lawrence, Kansas.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Anybody who's ever attended a football game at Ohio State's enormous horseshoe-shaped stadium knows it's an impressive edifice. But what about the 8-foot by 6-foot model of Ohio Stadium that Paul Janssen built in his basement using 1 million Legos? The stadium, which required about 1,000 hours of construction over a 2-year period, is rounded, and Legos are rectangles. That was part of the challenge Mr. Janssen faced. He also had to do some improvising using the chrome parts of a Lego truck to build the pipes for the restrooms in his stadium, in case any of the 6,000 Lego people at seats had to visit same. Weird, but perhaps no more weird than building the thing was.
Yes, I'm the Lego man, and yes, I'm the Lego man, and yes, I'm the Lego man. Most people don't understand. Yes, I'm the Lego man, yes, I'm the Lego man, and yes, I'm the Lego
man. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, an iron, a thimble, and a top hat in high-stakes competition. But first, The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is investigating cyclist Lance Armstrong, and a federal grand jury has been hearing testimony since August. At issue is whether Armstrong coordinated doping among his teammates from 1999 to 2004 while riding on the U.S. Postal Service team. For years, Armstrong has vehemently denied accusations that he utilized blood doping and performance-enhancing drugs. In their article, The Case Against Lance Armstrong, in the current issue of Sports Illustrated, Selena Roberts and David Epstein examine the accusations against the seven-time Tour de France winner, and they reveal previously unreported details. The reporters join me now from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Selena, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having us.
And David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Selena, because Armstrong's team was supported by government funding through Postal Service sponsorship, the FDA's investigation could result in charges including conspiracy, wire fraud, money laundering, racketeering, and drug trafficking. How does allegedly cheating in the Tour de France lead to charges normally reserved for mob figures and high-ranking members of the drug trade?
When you look at this situation and your underlying premise, if you're the government, what you're trying to find out is, was the miracle of Lance, was the great things he did in the Tour de France, the victories, was that true? Was it real or was it based on a fraud? And the fraud in this case would be the doping angle. If you think of the doping as sort of the maypole in this situation where all the other charges wrap around it, if you discover that he doped, then I think the government wants to understand, did he traffic the drugs that he was taking? Did he pressure other people on his team because he was considered the boss into taking them? Did he travel across borders with drugs? And if he won these Tour de France titles based on this fraud, then the government would like to ask the question, you know, the $50 million or close to that that Postal put into that team, was that all based on a fraud? And so I think that if you start from the doping, you see that so many other issues trickle down from that.
David, one of the revelations in the article concerns details about tests that anti-doping specialist Dr. Donald Catlin did on Armstrong on behalf of the U.S. Olympic Committee in the mid-1990s. Tell us what you discovered along that line.
Well, so Lance was a multiple-time Olympian in the 90s and was subject to the same testing as other Olympians, and part of that testing is what's called a TE ratio test, which is the testosterone to epitestosterone ratio in the body. Testosterone, we all know, is the kind of masculinizing hormone, and epitestosterone is just another hormone that doesn't really do much but comes in about a one-to-one ratio in most people in the body. So if you see a higher ratio, you can sometimes start to figure out whether somebody is artificially supplementing their testosterone. USA Cycling made a request for testing data for a specific athlete. We were told that was Lance Armstrong, even though originally he was only identified by his testing number. And we saw what were both fluctuating and abnormally high levels of testosterone to epitestosterone. For one reason or another, two of those high tests weren't able to be confirmed. Dr. Catlin couldn't really explain why that was. He said it's a once in a blue moon occurrence that would happen. And when I told him I was looking at three cases for the same athlete, he said that's very, very strange. And one of the cases, it didn't seem that any confirmation was even attempted.
A spokesman for Lance Armstrong called your article, and I'm quoting now, old news from the same old discredited sources. Regarding these tests that are more than a decade old, how do you respond to that?
You know, the people that we talk to have sworn under oath to what they discussed with us. They've talked to investigators where, again, they would be under oath. And when you look and say, well, why would they talk? A lot of them just want the truth out. So just because they say they're discredited doesn't mean there's any proof at all that their credibility is in question.
While individual champions get the credit, winning cycling events requires a team effort. You interviewed Steven Swart, who rode with Lance Armstrong in the 1990s. What did he say about Armstrong's alleged role in introducing doping to his team?
Well, this was back on the Motorola team in the mid-90s, and what Steven said was that the team wasn't doing as well as they wanted to, basically, and they knew that a lot of the European teams were doping, and that they were on a training ride after a performance that they considered subpar, and Lance, who was an influential member of the team, brought it up to him and another rider they were with, and suggested that people you know, get on a medical program involving EPO. And in Steven Swart's recollection, it was Lance was what he called the instigator of that team starting EPO, and Steven Swart himself, who admitted to using EPO after that.
Lance Armstrong is a seven-time Tour de France winner. He's a cancer survivor who's raised millions and millions of dollars to fight that disease. He has, of course, attained a celebrity status beyond that of any other athlete in his sport. How do his fame and good works factor into this investigation going forward? What do you think?
Well, you know, in our society, heroes are people too. And, you know, we scrutinize heroes in every walk of life, whether they're ministers or whether they're heroes in politics. But the scrutiny on everybody, I think, should be equal. And I would say that, you know, Lance himself, it doesn't mean that you can do great work, and by doing great works, it inoculates you from scrutiny. I think in so many ways, those who do great work should welcome the transparency and should welcome the scrutiny, because there's so much on the line. So many people trust them.
And it also doesn't negate the things that he's done, whatever happens. It doesn't take back the inspiration he's given people or the money he's raised and things like that. But we've gotten the question quite a bit, even if it turns out that it's proven that he was doping, wasn't it all worth it? And I think that's a question. It depends if you're looking at it in retrospect or if you think about it being on the front end with an athlete asking you, should I, you know, take these drugs or do something bad because down the line it might pay off. So it's a tough philosophical question.
The federal prosecutor leading this investigation is Jeff Nowitzki, who is also heading up the perjury case against Major League Baseball's Barry Bonds. He oversaw the prosecution that led to the conviction of Marion Jones, the track star, as well. Do you have any sense of whether Nowitzki has given Armstrong's case priority over any of his other work at this point?
Jeff probably is somebody where, you know, he's focused on the moment. And I would guess that given the way he's handled cases in the past, he's very focused on this right now. But I think we all know that looming ahead is the Barry Bonds trial that is supposed to come up in March, I believe. So I think that his focus is where it probably has to be in the moment, but I would guess that at some point, he's going to start focusing on the Barry Bonds trial.
Lance Armstrong came out of retirement to return to cycling back in 2009. Where does his career stand now?
Well, this is his last professional year. I mean, he's in the Tour Down Under right now, saying goodbye to that run. I think that, you know, when he came back in 2009, he said he was coming back to raise awareness for cancer advocacy and the projects that he wanted. So I think he's more in the mode of you know, riding hard and riding well through this sunset period.
Selena Roberts and David Epstein's article, The Case Against Lance Armstrong, appears in the January 24th issue of Sports Illustrated. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
And Selena, thank you to you as well.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Monopoly is fake money, and the heartbreak of landing on Boardwalk when somebody else has built a big red hotel there. Only in Monopoly are you likely to rejoice at being sent to jail, knowing it may delay financial ruin. A new movie titled Under the Boardwalk explores the delights of the board game that has thrilled and dismayed millions of people in over 40 different countries for all sorts of reasons.
Playing Monopoly is the only time where you can bankrupt your friends and they will still be your friends.
Certainly that's one of those reasons, courtesy of John Mayer, a dedicated player featured in Under the Boardwalk. Joining me now to discuss the movie in which that line is featured is Kevin Tostado, the producer and director of Under the Boardwalk. Kevin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on, Bill.
In Monopoly, players roll dice to determine which properties they will land on, and then they can buy and eventually build on those properties and charge their opponents when they land on them, all of which sounds simple enough. Were you surprised at how wrapped up, perhaps even obsessed, some competitors have become with this game?
Not at all. I mean, Monopoly is a game that has been around for more than 75 years now, and certainly people want to be the best at things, and what better than to be able to become a millionaire through the game of Monopoly?
Among the world-class Monopoly players featured in Under the Boardwalk, there seems to be some difference of opinion about how much of the game is luck and how much is skill. Where do you come down in that debate?
Well, certainly you can't control the outcome of the dice unless you're using a set of weighted dice, but luck is always going to be there, and occasionally you will have the games where the properties that you land on aren't really the ones that you're looking for, but the way that people really stand out when they play the game of Monopoly is through their interpersonal skills, and that's learning how to negotiate with your opponents to get trades to be in your favor, and knowing what the probabilities are that you're going to land on a certain color group or that your opponents might land on them, and that's where you should focus your investment.
Knowing your opponent, interpersonal skills, this means like knowing a guy likes light blue better than dark blue, even if dark blue is a lot better property, something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, if somebody's from Chicago, they might have an affinity for Illinois Ave that you can try and exploit and kind of finding out kind of what was their favorite token or just different elements about kind of people's personalities that you can try and incorporate into your gameplay.
Now, Monopoly seems like the ultimate game for capitalists. The idea is to get all the money and leave everybody else with none. Yet the game that became Monopoly was invented back in 1903 by a woman who was an anti-capitalist. She had an absolutely anti-capitalist agenda. Tell us about Elizabeth Magee.
Elizabeth Magee was a follower of Henry George, who was an economist who promoted the single tax theory and that kind of all property should be taxed the same. And so her early game, which was called the Landlord's Game, was very much educational and was designed to help kind of spread this theory. And she actually pitched it to Parker Brothers in the early 20th century, and they rejected it and encouraged her to patent it. And so she patented it and started spreading it word of mouth, and it kind of made its way through classrooms. It definitely had a lot of economic principles that you could learn from the game. And over time, it kind of went through many different hands and eventually made its way to a gentleman by the name of Charles Darrow, who lived in Philadelphia. And if you look at the patents for the Landlord's Game and the patented version of Monopoly, you can clearly see some similarities in kind of how the game had evolved over that 30-year period.
I think one of the most intriguing characters in the film is a guy named Dominic Mergo. Let's listen to him as he prepares for a tournament in which his brother is also going to be competing.
I want to be world champion, and if it means squashing my little brother like a bug, I'm going to do it. But let me also say this. If, and only if, I am eliminated earlier, I want this guy to go all the way. And win, lose, or draw, he's always going to be my brother. I love you, Gabe.
Was Dominic Mergo any good, or did he just talk a good game?
Well, Dom is actually the 1995 Rhode Island state champion. They had a kind of a tournament for the youth back then. And his brother was also a Rhode Island state champion as well. And so the two of them both qualified for the 2009 U.S. Championship. And unfortunately, in that tournament, his antics didn't really fold over into him actually doing well in the tournament, but he held his own against some bigger opponents, and certainly he hopes to be back again. He has told me that if he can find a woman that will beat him at the game of Monopoly, he will marry her on the spot.
Yeah, well, this is assuming that she would be at all interested.
Exactly.
The most recent U.S. championship was in Las Vegas. Where and when is the next one going to be?
Well, they kind of recycle where they hold the tournaments every time. They tend to hold them every 4 years, kind of like the World Cup. Mm-hmm. The last U.S. championship was in Washington, D.C., and the World Championship was in Las Vegas, but they've held them all over the world. Before Las Vegas, the World Championship was in Japan. It's been in London, Monaco. They tend to pick kind of glitzy and glamorous cities that kind of evoke the feel of the game as the venue for it. So probably the next time that they'll be holding a set of U.S. and national tournaments will probably be in around 2013.
I'm speaking with Kevin Tostado, the producer and director of Under the Boardwalk, the Monopoly documentary, and you're listening to Only a Game. Monopoly has been a bonanza for Parker Brothers, of course, and it has outlasted thousands of other games. Having filmed all these players, do you have a sense of really what particularly accounts for Monopoly's extraordinary run?
There's a number of factors that kind of contribute to that, and I'm sure there's kind of some unseen ones that kind of just it came along at the right place at the right time. I mean, it really was first kind of published during the Depression, and much like the kind of the recent years that we've been going through with the recession, in that people like to kind of live vicariously through the game. And so you have this opportunity to become a landowner and to gather lots of money and properties. And that's something that many people have not yet had an experience to do so in their lives, especially kids. It's, for some, it's the first chance they've had an opportunity to handle paper money, even though it may not be U.S. currency. It kind of has that feel to them. But it's also a learning experience. And for many families, it's a bonding tool. I mean, I grew up with Monopoly in the house and got to the point where I took it so seriously that my family kind of stopped wanting to play with me because I always wanted to win. And they just wanted to have a good time.
Now, you mentioned, of course, the play money in Monopoly, but we should mention that these tournaments have real money involved. You, if you win, you get the amount of money that is in a Monopoly set, right?
And that's correct, $20,580. You get a Monopoly bank if you win.
Kevin, you mentioned that you played Monopoly as a youngster. Do you still play?
One of the reasons why I kind of created this documentary in the first place is Monopoly has always been my favorite board game, and I knew as a kind of a teenager that they had these different U.S. and world championships and that I wanted to try and qualify. But because they only hold them every 4 years, I always tended to think about it at the wrong times in the cycle. Back up to summer 2007, that's when I kind of realized that the next set was going to be coming up in the next couple of years. But also was deciding what to do for kind of my next feature film. And so I decided to kind of combine the two and to create this documentary about the game of Monopoly. And now that I've finished production on it, I have started to play in a couple local tournaments and held my own against some big players. I've beaten a past world champion at a table. I haven't made it to any final tables yet, but I still got a lot of time to practice before the next world championship.
Kevin Tostato is the producer and director of Under the Boardwalk, a new film about one of the world's most popular board games. The film acclaimed Best Documentary at the Anaheim International Film Festival will next be screened at the Sedona International Film Festival in Arizona at the end of February. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Giveaways of bobblehead dolls vaguely resembling players, free tickets for guys willing to have their heads shaved. Sports franchises have come up with all sorts of dandy promotions to increase attendance, but last weekend the Boston Blazers of the National Lacrosse League crossed the line, at least according to some of their fans. During halftime, the Blazers staged a contest to see which of three female contestants could give their mascot, Scorch, the best lap dance. Some fans were dismayed. "It was an absolute disgrace," said a message posted on the team's Facebook page. Another fan wrote, "You try explaining to my kids what they were doing to the mascot." Nobody associated with the Blazers took up that challenge, and neither will I. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, why winter is kite season, at least for some skiers. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
New York Jets head coach Rex Ryan said this week that when his guys play the Steelers tomorrow for the AFC title, it won't be personal. When New York was getting ready to play the Pats last week, Ryan, of course, said it was going to be personal. Does this mean the Jets have no chance against Pittsburgh?
No, it means Rex Ryan is a big fake. This game is no more or less personal than the Patriots game was. He just found a technique he thought would work against the Patriots the week before.
And it did.
And it sort of did, exactly. But I believe that if Pittsburgh were to beat up on the New York Jets and beat them thoroughly and whack them around, that Rex Ryan would suddenly find that to be personal.
During that Jets-Patriots game last week, cameras caught New England quarterback Tom Brady engaging in a practice which is not recommended. Really? Tom Brady?
Well, actually, it's sort of common. I didn't know about this. Apparently, for a long time, players have sniffed like smelling salts, ammonia smelling salts, on the sidelines to give them a lift in particularly tough games. Doctors, of course, say this is a wrong. It's not against the rules, apparently. But the point we must never forget in all of this is that without quote-unquote performance-enhancing drugs, unquote, the National Football League season would be 11 and a half minutes long.
I did find it interesting that the manufacturer of the smelling salt said, hey, wait a minute, that's not what you're supposed to do with our product.
You're supposed to be unconscious. Someone else is supposed to break the thing for you, you know?
The NFC Conference Championship will go to the Bears or to the Packers. What do you think?
I think it's terrific. I think that the pregame let's go back in the lore festivities is going to be about 4.5 hours long. I think any game that gets you thinking about Bart Starr and Gale Sayers is a terrific football game. I think the Packers are going to win because I think this is Aaron Rodgers' year to step up into the elite class of quarterbacks. So I do believe the Packers will win.
56 college football players who are not seniors will be available in the NFL draft in April. That's a record. Have these young men not heard about the possible lockout? Because it seems to me this would be a great year to elect to stay in school.
Well, yeah, but the other thing, of course, is that if there is somehow a settlement, I don't think there's going to be, but one of the things that's undoubtedly going to be in a settlement, no matter when that settlement comes, is some sort of rookie wage scale. These guys may be assuming, hey, look, draft me now. Maybe there won't be a lockout. Maybe the old rookie rules will be in place. I'm not sure whether or not they're betting the right way.
Charlie, for a mere $200, those wishing to take in the Super Bowl in Dallas may do so. The only catch is that for $200, those fans will be watching the game on a gigantic HD TV screen outside the stadium. Are you as shocked as I am to learn the NFL has never thought of charging $200 to watch the game from outside before?
I am at this point surprised that the NFL isn't going door-to-door to every house in the United States of America and charging $10 for you to watch it on your own high-definition television screen.
On Friday, Venus Williams withdrew from the Australian Open due to an injury. I was surprised to learn that this marked the first time Venus Williams had ever withdrawn from a Grand Slam singles match, and I'm even more surprised to learn that all people have something called a psoas muscle. What is a psoas muscle?
Well, if you hurt it, it gets very psoas, and you have to put
psoa, and you put some ice on
it. That's exactly right.
Yeah, and
okay, yeah, I know. Sometimes I just lay there, Bill. What can I tell you?
Well, in fact, it's a long muscle located on the side of the thoracic region of the vertebral column and brim of the lesser. I couldn't even get through it, but it's the lesser pelvis.
And if you're out there playing Scrabble right now rather than listening to Bill and I, and why wouldn't you be after the way this story is gone, this word begins with a P and not
yes,
an S.
It does. The University of Minnesota released the results of a study scholars there had been conducting. Apparently, 8% of fans leaving pro sports events are legally drunk. Now, that sounds low to me, but maybe it doesn't include the fans who punched out the guys who asked them to take breathalyzer tests in the parking lot.
This is interesting to me. It sounds a little bit low to me. And I think that as the study points out, that a typical NFL crowd is about 70,000 people. That means 5,600 people are leaving the stadium behind the wheels of their car drunk. Of course, if you've ever been in an NFL traffic jam, nobody drives until nobody can move until they sober up anyway.
Well, the next day, but, usually, right.
I do like the anecdotal evidence here that came in the story about the Buffalo Bills fan who was told, apparently, that he couldn't continue his ritual, which was to drink shots of liqueur from the thumb hole of a bowling ball. Think about that. How would you do that? I mean, unless
carefully.
You had a really huge mouth. Seriously, Mick Jagger could do this, but I don't think anyone else could.
During Tuesday night's loss to Alabama, Kentucky coach John Calipari bombarded freshman forward Terrence Jones with a string of obscenities that even offended Calipari's wife, according to reports. Calipari claims he, quote, got caught up in the emotion of the game. What's wrong with that? Isn't that what college coaches are supposed to do?
I watched the game, and I can tell you exactly what profanities he was using if you would like to know them. Wait, no, I can't
I
do that.
I wish to stay on the radio. Thank you very much.
I can't do that. However, gee, this was just a week until, since ESPN thought that John was a good person to be on their Contents of Character Town Hall from the Ebenezer Baptist Church to talk about the legacy of Dr. King. Because when I want to know about the legacy of Dr. King, an ethically dubious college basketball coach is my go-to guy.
And finally, two men ice fishing on Michigan's Black Lake claim that on a recent excursion they were attacked by a fish-wielding woman. You've lived in Wisconsin, Charlie, so you know that ice fishing can be dangerous. The ice can melt, the truck can fall through, but this dangerous?
First of all, if any researchers from the University of Minnesota are listening to the show, I guarantee you that more than 8% of ice fishermen are drunk when they leave the ice fishing facility. She also threw the fish at the men, but missed, which leads me to think she might be part of that more than 8% who's drunk when they leave the ice.
Anybody who's sober can throw a fish with a certain degree of accuracy.
Absolutely.
Sure. Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Ice shackers in paradise. Ice shackers in paradise. Ice shackers in paradise.
Before the New York Jets beat the New England Patriots last weekend, Jets designated pop-off Antonio Cromartie insulted Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. He called him a name junior high kids hear frequently as they walk between classes. Later, Tom Brady flashed a smile, thought happily about his paycheck and his supermodel wife, and said, "I've been called worse." Jets coach Rex Ryan had previously maintained that the game would come down to whether he or Pat's coach, Bill Belichick, was the greater genius. Predictable as the generation of hype and witless pot-stirring may be, this sort of nonsense can suggest to fans that the Jets are an especially unlikable lot. It may be true, but the progression of the Jets through the postseason has also generated some stories that are kind of fun. As it happened, I was in New York last weekend. From various neighborhoods, I could see the Empire State Building lit up green and white, which was downright festive, especially when a light snow was falling. I read later that on their return from New England, the Jets had asked the pilot if he could get the flight plan altered so they could get a better look at their glittering colors on the building.
Yeah, we got 200 people looking at it.
They apparently cared. That sentiment is kind of sweet. When the Jets-Pats game ended, I was on McDougal Street in Greenwich Village. Lots of people coming out of one of the bars on the block were wearing green and white caps and scarves. Several of them were chanting, J-E-T-S Jets, so they hadn't skipped school. No shots were fired. I didn't see anybody torching trash, turning over a car, or climbing into the high-tension wires, which puts at least those particular Jets fans a cut above the fans in various cities where big wins have inspired idiocy and worse. This does not mean that I'm a Jets fan. Maybe in Pittsburgh, some powerful eminence who heard about the green and white lights on the Empire State Building has realized that by turning off all the lights in one of that city's biggest buildings, they'd be showing at least one of their team's colors, black. If I find out that has happened, well, that's one for the Steelers, isn't it? Kites are good. Kites are fun. But they're also useful for high-performance sports like kite surfing, which became popular in the 90s. A relatively new sport uses those same heavy-duty kites for skiing and snowboarding. Expert kite skiers can shush at more than 50 miles per hour and jump dozens of feet in the air. The sport is picking up traction among thrill seekers and easygoing skiers alike. One of the top kite skiing spots in the East is tucked just west of the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports from the fourth annual Tug Hill Kite Skiing Festival.
If the Tug Hill Plateau north of Syracuse has anything, it's snow and wind. Storms off Lake Ontario dump feet of powder onto rolling fields and big dairy barns. And it's no coincidence the Tug is home to the East's largest collection of wind turbines. Today, the wind's driving hard from the south, and Jan Brabaugh's psyched.
What's happening now, the wind is coming right down through this valley. you know, then there's trees above, and that's causing turbulent air, and it's really pumping up fast.
Brabant's directing traffic in a big orange dome tent with a propane heater. This is it, the main base camp for the Tug Hill Kite Skiing Festival. Brabant's a local outfitter and helps run this event that attracts a couple hundred people each year. He says kite skiing itself is pretty simple. You wear a harness attached by long lines to a high-performance kite that pulls you along. He says it's what you do with that kite that's so addicting.
I get out there and I just have that kite go up and down to develop power. And that's all you hear is the sound, you know, and then a little fluff of the powder going through. And then if I feel my kite line start to tighten up, and then I can pop up, do a jump, and then come back down again. It's just so peaceful and tranquil.
But today the conditions are rough. In comes Carl Gesslein, a towering guy, and he's wide-eyed from a battle with the wind.
Yeah, I jumped 30 feet with the full D power and I didn't pull in the bar.
Gesslein comes here every winter from Ithaca. He's been kite skiing for almost a decade, and he says you can't beat the rush.
When it's really windy and you jump really high, it's just like getting shot out of a cannon or something, and there's really nothing like it. And you can go out if it's windy like this and just ride for 8 hours straight.
This is what's driving the growing popularity of kite skiing. It can be extreme or mellow. And with advances in safety equipment, people of all ages are giving it a try. Jackie Pitts had downhill skied just 3 times in her life before switching over to kite skiing.
You can go as slow as you want or as fast as you want. You can jump if you want to get up in the air. You can stay on the ground if you want to.
6 carloads of snow kiters from Massachusetts arrive. One guy's videotaping everything.
My name is Jean Dunoyer. How are we doing? I'm one of the founding members of masskiting.com.
Dunoyer says for the 3rd straight year, his online group rents a big house here. They snow kite during the day and party at night.
You know, we're here for the steady wind, the powder snow, the camaraderie, the group feeling. It's a very tight group. It's like we're a family. We, you know, go to each other's birthday parties and stuff like that.
I follow the Massachusetts crew out to the parking lot where they're gearing up. It's snowing hard now.
We waited all week and all night for this, so we got some good conditions. We got a good snowpack. It looks like we got some good winds.
Chris Haley's a bond trader from Boston. He straps a harness on top of his jacket and snow pants.
We watched some snowboarding videos last night, so everybody got fired up to try some new moves, and we'll see how we do, you know? Hopefully we all come back in one piece and have a lot of fun.
We hike up a rise through almost a foot of fresh powder. It's freezing with the temperatures in the teens. The snow's whipping sideways. Ron Heppenstall, a carpenter from Rutland, Massachusetts, is laying out his lines and pumping up his kite. It has inflatable ribbing because it's designed to float on water for kite surfing.
Right now the lines are hooked up and I'm just about ready to launch. The heart's pumping a little bit.
Heppenstall's a converted snowboarder, and it's his first trip to the Tug Hill.
Yeah, I can't call myself a snow kiter till I come to this event. So you get two things that are coming together. You already know how to snowboard. You love that. You add the wind factor, and it's just like twofold, that much better. You know, and you get to get away from the ski resorts. You get to get to places that are just serene. And too many crowds, just it can be a little too much.
Heppenstall takes in the wide expanse in front of us, just a hayfield donated by a local farmer. 12 kites are already in the air, neon specks swooping and bobbing in a landscape of total white. Then Heppenstall clips into his snowboard. He signals to his buddy to launch his kite.
Hey, Jean, pull me up.
Then he leans back and gains control of the kite.
Bring you the full power. I'm going to head off right to that way.
And just like that, shush, he's off. He slices down a hill. The kite juts and jags. Then it pulls him up a hill just as fast. He catches some air at the top. This is what makes kite skiing such a thrill and why it's taken off with backcountry skiers, too. You don't have to buy a lift ticket or slog up a peak. Zebulon Jacobs, a kite skiing instructor from New Hampshire, usually he summits Mount Washington in 8 hours, up and down. One time kite skiing, he did it in 2 hours.
Instead of walking the route and skiing uphill or downhill, the kite, and instead of hiking uphill at 2 miles per hour, you can kite uphill at 30.
There are kite skiing tournaments, races for speed, contests for tricks and jumps. 2009 kite skiing national champion Patrick Nadel came to last year's Tug Hill Festival. But here, there's no competition, just the interplay of natural forces and a lot of space. And that suits Zeb Jacob just fine.
Looking behind your shoulder and seeing the sun setting, or the snowflakes are so, they're in a stellar crystal phase because it's so cold out, that just noticing maybe just noticing the little things within the big picture is nice.
By afternoon, the wind's really whipping. A lot of snow kiters call it quits. But tomorrow's another day on the Tug Hill, and with it, a promise of more snow and more wind. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein. Kites are fun. Kites are fun. Kites are fun. See my kite, it's fun. See my kite, it's green and white. Laughing in its distant flight. All that's between us is a little yellow string. But we like each other more than anything. And we run along together through the field behind my house.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino. We had help this week from Kurt Conan at KPBS in San Diego, Julie Fredino at WSHU in Connecticut, Steven Steigman at KCUR in Kansas City, the Baylor Sports Network from IMG College, and from the Boston area snowplow drivers. Thank you, lads. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view David Summerstein's kite skiing photos, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from some of the nation's finest air traffic controllers as they guide the Only a Game staff jet so that it can get a closer look at the Only a Game towers all lit up in the official Only a Game colors.
That's beautiful. 200 heading, count 1950.
Power outage? Oh, man. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.